Good morning. Happy Father's Day to the dads that are here. It's so important for the fathers to recognize their role in charting the course of their household and in setting the tone for the way that house operates. And I just want to encourage the dads that are here today to just see that as a really high and holy calling. And I would just encourage you to sort of see yourself as the pastor of that household in the same way that Terra Nova has three pastors, elders. You really are sort of the shepherd, the pastor of that household. And so hats off to the dads. I don't know if you got breakfast in bed or a bowl of cereal. Personally, I've sort of come to not really expect a whole lot for Father's Day. And the primary reason for that is because I've botched up Mother's Day so much that I just don't have any right. When my wife was pregnant with our first child, she was about 8.5 months pregnant on Mother's Day. And Mother's Day had gone mostly through. And Amy finally said to me, "You realize it's Mother's Day, right?" And I turned to her and said, "You haven't given birth yet." Just a little tip, okay? Don't say that, okay? If your wife is 8.5 months pregnant on Mother's Day, buy her a freaking gift, okay? Just trust me. The next year, it was Mother's Day, and we found ourselves in Europe. Someone had given us free tickets and a free hotel in Paris, and we were walking around Paris, and my wife said, "You realize it's Mother's Day, right?" And I said, "Not in Europe," which is true. They don't really, I think it's one of those Hallmark things. They don't really celebrate. I think London has something called Mothering Day. I don't know. But they didn't celebrate it in Paris, so I felt like I was off the hook. But just take it from me, just no matter where you are in the world, no matter where your wife is in pregnancy, buy her a gift on Mother's Day. And then maybe Father's Day will have some kind of reward. Anyway, it's just part of the life of what it is. But I wanted to just say a quick congratulations to a couple of weddings that have happened in the last couple of weeks. I see Bob and Sarah Coward here. Bob and Sarah got married last weekend. Good to. Yesterday, Matt and Frida Miller got married. And let's see, a few weeks back, we had Jackie and Spencer Martin, and we had a baby born a couple weeks ago, Sky Keperudis. So just a lot of cool stuff, sort of just the family, the life of the church just sort of happening, and it's all part of that. You've got births and weddings, and we're kind of a young church, so I don't expect a whole lot of funerals anytime soon, but yeah, who knows. But it's all part of the life of the church, and it's just good to see that happening, to see people making commitments to each other in marriage and just trying to raise godly children, and we just encourage you in that. Let's take a minute, we'll open in prayer, and then we will get into the last part of Acts chapter 15. Father God, we just thank you for this day, and we thank you for a chance to worship you, to sing songs, to come before your word and to submit to it. To come before you in prayer, to come before you as a community, as followers of Christ. I pray that this time that we spend in your word would honor you, that as we try to learn from it, as we try to apply it to our lives, that you would be in charge of this time, that every word that is spoken, every word that is heard, honors you and elevates you. God, we want this to be a time that speaks of Jesus Christ. This is not a time to elevate man. It is a time to elevate you. God, I pray that you would allow me, with that in mind, to step out of your way and to simply let you speak. God, I pray that you would do that today. God, if there are things that we need to hear, if we need to be pushed a bit, I pray that you would do that. If we need to be encouraged, I pray that you would do that. Wherever we are, God, I pray that you would meet us there and that we would, again, honor you in that. I pray all these things in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, and in the power of your Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, last week, Pastor Ed took us through the first 35 verses of chapter 15. If this is your first time here, Ed is our normal teaching pastor, lead teaching pastor, poet, priest, philosopher, extraordinaire, whatever you want to call him. He's the guy who does about 80% of the teaching, and I give him a break from time to time. And we saw the church in that first part of chapter 15, we saw the church deal with a conflict that was just tearing many congregations apart. It was this issue of circumcision and whether or not as a Gentile, a non-Jewish convert to Christianity, whether or not you were required to be circumcised as a male. It seems like an odd issue for us today because it seems so removed from what we would even be discussing. But in Jewish culture, it was very important, and it was just tearing congregations apart. In that situation, we actually saw a pretty good resolution. People came together, they discussed, they argued, they went back and forth, but ultimately they came to an agreement, and people seemed to be on the same page. That will not be the case in today's text. Today we look at conflict that doesn't go well. Today we look at what happens when you can't agree, when you can't resolve, when you can't just get along. One of the things I love about the Bible is that it's not a whitewashed book that attempts to clean up all the characters and sort of make them look like something from a 1950s sitcom. It leaves all the stuff right there for us to see. What we get in the Bible is reality. Everyday, gritty, dirty reality. And today we're going to see the reality of conflict unresolved. Let's jump into this passage, and we'll see what we can learn from that. We left off last week with Paul and Barnabas in Antioch. They were teaching and preaching together. The first missionary journey is over. The second one's about to begin. If you're unfamiliar with the book of Acts, there are these three missionary journeys that are talked about. If you've got one of those Bibles with maps at the back, you probably have a map of the journeys in there somewhere. And what these journeys were, they were like tours where Paul and Barnabas and others went out preaching and teaching and sort of spreading the gospel out into that part of the world. The first missionary journey is over. The second one's about to begin. And Paul and Barnabas, once again, are planning this out. They're figuring out where they're going to go. And it makes sense that they'd be working together. Paul and Barnabas have been through a lot of life together. If you think of Barnabas' backstory with Jesus, it started well before the Apostle Paul's story with Jesus. Barnabas was an early convert to Jesus Christ. He was a Levite, which at the very least meant that he would have been seen as a natural leader amongst people. He would have automatically been given some sort of leadership place. The interesting thing with him and Paul and their relationship is that on this very first missionary journey, it began with Barnabas at the helm and not Paul. Barnabas was in charge and not Paul. We know Paul, we think of Paul as such a alpha male kind of very sort of dominant personality. It's hard to imagine him as someone's subservient. But in fact, at the beginning of this journey, he was. At some point during that first missionary journey, the role of lead leader shifted from Barnabas to Paul. Both are apostles. Both are strong leaders. Both are men gifted by God and sent out to preach Jesus Christ. But of the two, one rises to the top, and leadership naturally shifts to Paul. Now the second missionary journey is about to begin. And it only makes sense then that Paul and Barnabas are working together on it. They've been in Antioch for a while. It's time to move on. Chapter 15 has this to say. We'll pick it up there in verse 36. It says, after some time, Paul said to Barnabas, let's return to each city where we previously preached the word of the Lord and see how the new believers are getting along. Barnabas agreed and wanted to take along John Mark. But Paul disagreed strongly since John Mark had deserted them in Pamphylia, and had not shared in their work. All right, we'll stop there for a minute. What do we know about this situation? You've got Paul and Barnabas and this other character, John Mark. Paul doesn't want to take him. Barnabas does. Let's start with the people involved. What do we know about Paul? Paul is the murderer turned Christian. He's the guy who, before he came to Christ, was literally all about killing and persecuting Christians. He becomes a Christian himself, starts preaching and serving alongside of the very people that he was once trying to kill. Paul definitely wins the award for most dramatic conversion to Christ. He's got, you know, the faith story that if you grew up in the church, you kind of felt like you were, you know, like lame because all you could say is, I don't know, I became a Christian when I was 4. And you're like, this guy used to kill people. That's so cool. But it's really not. But he becomes a Christian, and he begins to be a real force of leadership in the church. In terms of personality, probably a bit of an extremist, definitely very driven, may have workaholic tendencies, bit of a slave to pragmatism. The redeemed side of those personality traits are that he jumped full force into everything he was doing, right? When he was killing people, he was really killing them. When he became a Christian, he really preached God. He really preached Jesus. Very passionate. That's the other side of that, the redeemed side. He would work extremely hard to accomplish what God had set before him. And he would do whatever it takes to get the job done. So he's a good guy. He's a hard worker. A little bit intense, probably, but a good guy. Here's how Paul defines his life mission. This is a good sort of window into his soul. It says, one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead, I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. And that's from Philippians. Here's Paul's summary of his own life from 2 Timothy. He says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. He says that towards the end of his life. Paul's a very goal-oriented guy. He's going to do anything to accomplish what has been set before him. In 1 Corinthians, he says this. He says, I have become all things to all men that I might by all means save some. He is, you know, a good pragmatist in that way. Paul is type A, high D, driven personality. And God uses that part of Paul to accomplish some pretty amazing things. We really can't underestimate the impact that Paul has had on the church, even up to today. And then there's Barnabas, right? Barnabas likes people. He's a really nice guy. He's serving alongside of Paul, and you know, his name actually means son of encouragement or exhortation or consolation. Barnabas is just a really nice guy. You can't help but like Barnabas. Paul, maybe he could be a bit of a jerk at times, but Barnabas, you can't help but like the guy. At one point, this just shows you how generous he is. At one point, he sold a piece of property because the church needed the money. Just said, that's it. I'll just get rid of it. Extremely loyal, too. When the leaders in Jerusalem were ripping apart Paul and just attacking him verbally, Barnabas comes to his defense. You can trust Barnabas. When they needed just a huge sum of money transported from one church to another, Barnabas was the one they asked to carry it. He's just a good, faithful, loving guy. On top of all this, he's humble. When Paul assumed leadership on that first missionary journey, Barnabas willingly moved from being number one to number two. Now, the unredeemed side of Barnabas' personality, we knocked Paul a little bit, we'll knock Barnabas too. The unredeemed side of that is that he probably had some sort of people-pleaser tendencies, right? We get some indication of this in Galatians when he sides with the crowd that want to enforce those old circumcision rules. And he says, let's go along with that again. So he kowtows to them, and he goes in on it. I like a point that Ed often makes about how every personality trait has that redeemed side and that unredeemed side. The workaholic is also a hard worker. The people person or the people pleaser is also a people lover. Barnabas is a leader, just as Paul is a leader, but their leadership styles are drastically different. When you're a people person like Barnabas, you're more likely to see the potential in someone and want to work with that person and guide that person. When you're more goal-oriented like Paul, you want to accomplish the task. The people person will say to the goal-oriented person, you don't care about people. The goal-oriented person will respond, get some work done, right? Just stop talking and get some work done. you can elevate one guy at the expense of the other, but the reality is that each is used by God for his purposes. When Luke writes the book of Acts and he shows us this conflict that happened between them, he's not showing the good guys versus the bad guys. It's not Paul is good and Barnabas is bad or vice versa. They're both good guys. Paul and Barnabas each play a critical role in developing the church. The difference is that Paul's role is more vocal, more public, and therefore more memorable. It's going to get written about. Barnabas is a leader. Paul is a leader of leaders. And yet, if it weren't for Barnabas, you can imagine that possibly John Mark might have given up on serving God when Paul rejected him. Instead, he served faithfully for many years as a missionary and a teacher and a preacher. So what do we know about John Mark? Who is this guy? By the way, some of your translations will say that his name was John, but everyone called him Mark, which seems kind of weird, like, hi, my name's Phil, but you can call me Arnold. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Basically, what it is that John was his Jewish name, Marcus was his Roman name. So that's kind of the simple answer for that. John Mark was one of the first church kids. He was one of the first kids who could say that he sort of grew up in the church. He grew up sort of being in the church from a certain age on. His mom was this very godly woman who hosted prayer meetings in her home. Peter, who was really one of the most important characters in the New Testament, had such affection for John Mark that he called him my son. And it's possible that Peter was the one who led John Mark to Christ ultimately. And so he thinks of him as a sort of a spiritual son. John Mark may have started a church in Alexandria, Egypt. There's a lot of indication for that. At the very least, he spent the majority of his life spreading the truth of Christ. We don't find John Mark curled up in the fetal position in some corner crying about the fact that Paul rejected him. We just don't see that. We see him living his life for Christ and being a leader and being a servant at the same time. And yet the place where we meet John Mark for the very first time is in Acts chapter 13 as he is abandoning the first missionary journey. Barnabas, who incidentally is John Mark's cousin, and Paul, they've just confronted a guy who is into the dark arts. He's into witchcraft and sorcery. They didn't toss the guy in the water to see if he would float. Instead, they made him blind and went about their work. But it's shortly after this that John Mark, who was traveling with Paul and Barnabas as sort of like a junior helper, decides, you know what? I'm out of here. I'm not hanging around. We don't know exactly why he left. The text doesn't say. Maybe he got freaked out by all this, you know, casting out demons stuff. Maybe he just said, you know what? This was not in the job description. I'm not interested in this. I'm going to go home. Who knows? Maybe he realized that he just wasn't cut out for this sort of work yet. Maybe he figured out that he needed more time. Maybe he just missed his mom. Who knows, right? He just missed the home cooking and decided to go home. The word that's used to describe his leaving is the word for apostasy, which can mean something as bad as he left the faith, like he denied Christ, or as little as he just left. It could be either extreme. Again, we're not exactly sure why he left. What we do know is that when Paul and Barnabas needed him most on that first missionary journey, he left them high and dry. He let them down. And for that reason, Paul is just unwilling to trust him again. Which forces us to ask, what is the right response to someone letting you down, when you just get let down? My guess is that everyone in this room has at some point been let down pretty badly, right? And if we're honest, probably at some point you've let someone else down pretty badly. When someone lets you down, what do you do with that? Do you just sort of blacklist them for the rest of your life and just never trust them again, never work with that person again? Do you perpetually punish that person, which is something that a lot of people do unconsciously when someone's let them down? If the statistics are correct, then half of you sitting in this room right now come from homes where your parents got divorced, and that was perhaps a huge letdown for you. Some of you have already gone through divorce yourself, and that was a letdown, depending on regardless really of where the blame is placed for that. Now, occasionally the kids of a divorced family will look back on a divorce and say, you know, it was for the best in our situation. I've heard one person say that in my life, but it's kind of rare. Because of this, a lot of you carry around hurt from this or from relationships that were broken. You carry around hurt and just sort of feelings of, I've been let down and I can't trust people again. You know, maybe you were in just a really close friendship with somebody and that person so seriously betrayed your confidence and your trust that you just are burned from ever trusting someone again. You've been let down and now you're not going to trust again. That's a difficult way to live. It's not really a fun way to live. Let's look at Paul for a second. I don't want to psychoanalyze the mind of the Apostle Paul, but if one of his most trusted advisors in the world, Barnabas, this guy who has traveled with him, who they've probably prayed together for hours as they've been doing ministry together, if Barnabas felt that John Mark could be trusted again, maybe Paul should have taken his advice. This was not someone who would just sort of go on to do nothing. John Mark went on to become a leader in the church. This was not some friendship charity case, someone you take along because you feel bad for him. Maybe Paul had deep hurts of his own that kept him from trusting John Mark, a man that had clearly let them down. Maybe Paul should have given him a second chance. Maybe Paul was wrong. A lot of times we don't think of that, right? That a character in the Bible could be wrong, but there are bad characters in the Bible, or there are good characters that act badly at times. Paul is obviously a good character in the Bible, but he is not perfect. He is human. Maybe Paul was wrong, or maybe Paul was right. Maybe Paul recognized that the mission of God, the mission that God had set before him was too big to mess around with unpredictable people who had a bad track record. Maybe he viewed John Mark as extra baggage and he could not afford to be slowed down on this mission. He needed people he could trust. Maybe Paul recognized that John Mark may still have potential, but also recognized that this missionary journey was not a training mission, but a doing mission, and that there just wasn't time to take along an intern and be a mentor. Again, we could speculate all day. We could argue convincingly one way or the other, but this much we know. Paul felt extremely certain that John Mark could not accompany them on this journey. And Barnabas felt extremely certain that he should. And so Paul and Barnabas, two godly leaders, come to that fork in the road and they decide they're not going to budge and they need to split ways. Verse 39 tells us that their disagreement over this was so sharp that they separated. Barnabas took John Mark with him and sailed for Cyprus. Paul chose Silas, and the believers sent them off, entrusting them to the Lord's grace. And so they traveled throughout Syria and Cilicia to strengthen the churches there. And so two extremely influential leaders, apostles, split apart, and they go their separate ways. On the upside, what would have been one missionary journey becomes two. And as a result, Paul goes off and does his thing, while Barnabas goes off and does his thing, and these men are then free to be leaders in a way that best suits their personalities. And they're both able to reach different people. Their efforts are doubled. You could call it conflict, or you could call it multiplication, depending on your perspective. My dad has been a pastor for nearly 40 years. He's retiring in a couple of weeks. And he said that the church he's in right now, bit of a troubled church. He said we've had six unintentional church plants, which means that they've had six churches split out of that church. And you could say, well, there's some bad things there, or you could say it's multiplication. We have this tendency in the church to act as though all conflict is bad, that all conflict must be resolved in a way that keeps everybody together. And at the end of the day, we all need to stand around the campfire and holding hands and singing, you know, friends are friends forever, whatever. I think this comes from a false belief that unity in the church means that we all agree on everything, that we see everything eye to eye, that we're all on the page, on the same page, all the time. Every pastor, every person in the church, every church in full agreement all the time. That this is sometimes put forward as a definition of what it means to be unified in the church. But throughout Scripture, it's clear that unity is in many ways stronger through diversity. That there are other ways to accomplish Christ's mission on this earth than just one specific church's idea about that or one person's idea about that. The church is often compared in the Bible to a human body with feet and hands and a head, and Christ is always the head. If he's not the head, we are going in the wrong direction. But the foot will always sort of look at the hand and think, you know, that hand really ought to spend more time on the ground. That's where the action is. You should spend more time on the ground. Speaking as a foot, you should be on the ground, right? And the hand will look to the foot and say, you just walk around. You're not doing anything. You're just walking around. But the church needs all aspects, all personalities, all giftings. And so in the church, you have different people with different passions. And oftentimes we can slip into this mode where we sort of all feel like our area of passion, our area of ministry is the most important in the whole church, right? It's possible that if you're on the worship team, you could think to yourself, you know, the worship team is really the most important aspect of Terra Nova. That's really the key. Or if you're the super outgoing person, and you could think, you know, if you're not a greeter, you're really not out there with people. That's really the place you should be there. You know, or if you're the person who just sort of goes out and does whatever needs to be done, setting up chairs or picking up trash on the sidewalk or whatever it is, you could think, you know, I'm really doing the stuff that no one else will do here. This is really where ministry happens. Or you could say, you know, I'm on the prayer team, and really, if you're not on the prayer team, you must not really care about God. Why aren't more people signing up for that, right? It's easy to sort of look wherever you are and just think, you know, this is really the place to be. This is the best type of ministry you can do. You see my point? God creates us in a certain way. That creation is then impacted by God-ordained experiences like family and friends and our jobs and our education and our experiences, our tragedies and our successes. And when you come to Christ, you're then given spiritual gifts that you're then to use to advance God's mission on this earth. And through all of this, we become who we are. And God desires to take the best of that and to redeem it and to use it to glorify himself by leading others to Christ. And the reality is that within the confines of Christian doctrine, basic doctrine, there are a million ways to accomplish that goal. Paul was not better than Barnabas. He was different. Sometimes God is better served when one mission becomes two, as it did with Paul and Barnabas. And so then a natural question that we should ask ourselves when attempting to apply this passage to our lives is, what constitutes a good reason to allow conflict or a difference of opinion to end in division or separation? And I'm not talking here about divorce. That's really not in the range of this passage. I'm talking about issues of conviction, issues of preference, issues of mission, issues of vision, issues of what God has put on your heart to do in this world, how he has gifted you, how he has instructed you to live your life. When is it right to separate? And how should we do that well? When is it right to quit a job? When is it right to end a friendship? When is it right to leave a church? When we started this church, we did so because we believed that God had given us a unique vision. We believed that God had given us a unique mission, and that this vision and mission required a new church that could be crafted and shaped from the ground up, rather than retrofitting an older, more established church. It doesn't mean that other churches are bad. It means that they're different. And it's good to have multiple churches with multiple strategies reaching multiple groups of people. But a lot of people would say that I'm wrong. That when you start a church, I've actually had somebody say this to me, when you start a church, all you're doing is dividing people. I was in Boston last week at a friend's bachelor party. And just as a little side note here, when you're planning a bachelor party in a major city, and you know you're going to be walking around with a group of people that are clean-cut and well-dressed, just double-check to make sure that it's not Gay Pride weekend in that city. It just tends to mess up the whole bachelor party mood. Just a little side note there. So I'm in Boston with a bunch of friends, and we're walking around, and this guy was telling me this guy that was with me, he was telling me how all these people are leaving his church. And I said, you know, why are they leaving your church? He said, well, you know, they disagree with where the pastor wants to take the church in the future. And then he went on to say that he felt that no one should ever, ever leave a church unless it's over a doctrinal dispute. Like, you know, the pastors of the church, the leadership of the church is, you know, they're teaching something that doesn't fit with the Bible. He said, that's the only reason you should leave a church. And I thought, man, if that were the case, Terra Nova would have like 8 people in it. Because, you know, we're this new church, and so many of you came here to start Terra Nova because you felt called to be here. The reality is that new churches like ours are filled with people like that just have decided, I feel like God is saying, you need to go do this. You need to go and be a part of that church. Many of you spent months praying and sort of agonizing over that decision, knowing that you would miss your friends and that you would be missed. I myself was the pastor of another church and left to come here. That was a hard decision. Hard decisions that result in separation. And as I was reading and studying this passage, I just kept thinking about those of you that have left another church to come here. And I know that some of you went through several steps to make sure that you left well, that you covered all the bases, that you wrote the right letters, and you talked to the right people. But I also know that some of you just sort of disappeared, like John Mark disappeared. And maybe you let people down. You abandoned one mission for another, both good missions, but you never really said why. And I just want to really encourage you, if you're one of those people that left one church to sort of join in on the mission of Terra Nova, I want to really encourage you to go back and make sure you left well. Did you tell anybody you were leaving? Do the pastors know why you left? Are there letters that need to be written? Nice, friendly letters, not hate letters. Pastors don't even read those. They just file them in the trash. Are there conversations that need to happen? I know of one guy here at Terra who is sort of the poster child for leaving well. He spent the better part of a year praying about whether or not he should come here. In one sense, he felt so strongly that God was calling him to be a part of this church. But in another sense, he felt like, you know, God's using me in my current church, serving in just simple ways. He was growing, he was impacting people, but you can't deny the call of God. And so after nearly a year of praying about this, really going all the way back to the planning stages of Terra Nova, after a year of praying about this, he finally decided, I've got to go. I've got to go over to Terra Nova. I just know that I'm running from God's call otherwise. And so he wrote a letter to his pastor and a couple other key leaders in the church requesting to be released from the covenant that he had signed. And he made it clear that he wasn't mad at anyone. He wasn't leaving over doctrine. He wasn't bored. He just sensed an overwhelming call to be here, to be a part of what we're doing here. And he knew that that's where he was supposed to be. And so he separated, but he did it well. If you need to go back and do some patchwork at the church you used to be a part of, will you have the guts to go and do that? I know it's hard. I know that no one really wants to go to someone and say, listen, I'm going over there now. I just feel like that's where I'm supposed to be. Prayed about it. I feel like that's where God's calling me. Go and make sure you left well. If you promise to serve in a particular area, do that until you're done, until your commitment is done. If you, you know, made a pledge of money to some building project or some other project, don't give a dime to Terra Nova until you've fulfilled that commitment, that promise. We want you to be here in a pure way, in a way that doesn't have baggage still hanging on from wherever you were before. And the reality is that if we as pastors are doing our jobs well, then someday some of you will feel called to go elsewhere. And we'll send you out on a new mission that is different than Terra Nova's mission. We may have a disagreement over how church should be done, and you will feel compelled to leave, and that's okay. You have to be true to what God has called you to. Issues of mission and vision, they're not doctrinal issues, they're issues of calling. Paul and Barnabas each had a calling on their life from God. They each had a mission to accomplish. And it just so happened that those missions could not be accomplished together. And that's really the best reason for separating in a friendship, in a work environment, separation from a church. The best reason is that the God-centered calling that is on your life cannot be realized in the situation that you're in the environment that you're in. When that's the case, it's time to go, because you have to honor the calling that's on your life. Now, if this is all you knew of Paul and Barnabas, you might think, man, it didn't end so well. I mean, you know, if they're at the apostles' reunions and they both happen to go for the potato salad at the same time, like, is it a big conflict? Do they get into a little fight with each other about how they, you know, sort of split off? The reality is that they actually worked things out. We know that Paul made up with Barnabas at some point. You know, Paul, being who he is, probably said something gruff like, "You're okay, Barnabas," and maybe slugged him on the shoulder a little bit playfully. And, you know, Barnabas probably gave him an uncomfortably long hug and then, you know, wrote a really encouraging letter filled with words of affirmation. Just personalities, you know. Paul later mentions Barnabas in the way that you would a trusted coworker that you just really feel, this is a guy that I'm serving with, even if you're serving in different areas. He speaks highly of him. They probably traveled together again at some point, at least one other time. We also know that Paul grew in his respect for John Mark. Later in his life, when he's in a difficult spot, he actually requests John Mark's help, saying, "You know, please bring this guy to me because he's helpful to me in my ministry." Paul may be a driven, goal-oriented guy, but ultimately he's not a jerk. And I believe that over time he came to recognize the value of people like Barnabas and John Mark. A few years in a prison cell on false charges tends to soften just about anybody. So where do you stand today on these unresolved issues? Is there a relationship in your life that ended poorly that needs some attention? Is there a pastor somewhere wondering where the heck you've been for the last 6 months? Is there someone you dismissed as untrustworthy like John Mark that deserves a second chance in the spirit of Barnabas, the great encourager? That stuff can weigh us down so much, and it can keep us from moving forward, and it can definitely keep you from living the life that God has for you and from doing the mission that God has for you. It just weighs us down. Get the ball rolling this week if there is unresolved conflict in your life that needs to be ended well. Get it started this week. Make a promise to God that you're going to do that this week. You're not going to put it off until next year, but you're going to do it now. And if you need counsel or advice on how to do that, how to handle that, call the office, call one of us. Our numbers are in the guide page. You can see our email addresses there and get in touch with us. Talk to your New Tribes leaders if you're in a new tribe. Talk to your leader there and ask for advice there. Let that conflict glorify God. Don't let it end. Don't let it hang around for the next 10 years. Deal with it. In a minute, the worship team is going to come back up to the stage and they're going to lead us in worship. And the communion team will come to the front and they'll stand and you'll have plenty of time before coming forward for communion. This is a chance for you to pray before God. This is a chance for you to confess sin before God. You should always do that before coming forward for communion. Just sort of spend some time quietly as we're singing, or even make those songs that we sing prayers to God and just be saying, God, is there things in my life that I need to clear out? Unresolved conflict, unresolved sin that needs to be cleared out, confessed, brought before God, and then left there. And then any other conversations that need to happen outside of church to make sure that that conflict is handled, that that sin is handled. You'll have two songs of time to come forward, and you can take a piece of matzah and dip it in either the wine or the juice. The matzah represents Christ's body that was broken for us, that was given for us as a gift and as a way of helping us, allowing us the only way that allows us to deal with our sin, that we can come before Jesus Christ as sinners and his body is broken for us and his blood is spilled out for us. And then when God looks at us, he doesn't see us as sinners. He sees us as forgiven because the blood of Christ covers us. If you are not a follower of Christ today, if you know that you have not made that commitment to Christ yet, spend some time in prayer about that. And if you are ready to make that kind of a commitment, talk to one of us before you leave, or talk to the person that you came with if they're a regular here, and figure out what that means. Figure out what it means in your life to place your faith in Jesus Christ. Let's close in prayer. Father God, we just thank you for another chance to come before you in your word, to submit to you. God, I pray that you would continue to work in our hearts to apply this passage to our lives, to make these last few minutes we have together as we sing some songs together and as we take communion together and as we ask for your forgiveness together, that you would make this time an act of worship that is a way for us to offer praise to you, that is a way for us to thank you for all of the amazing things you've done in our lives. God, I pray that you would use this time today in your name, in the power of your Spirit. Amen.